the Willis Graph, made in 1982, December the 6th. As I review the diary of my experiences on the Alaska Highway in 1942. In March of 1942, I was working at plant maintenance for the Columbia Aircraft Company, a wartime industry making bomb bay doors and ailerons in old Terminal Number 2 at the foot of Southeast Washington Street in Portland. Period. This job was one I had obtained in the defense industry as I was awaiting my draft call and was not necessarily geared toward a career. I was boarding in Portland at the time with a lady whose husband was the guard at the plant and did not have much to do evenings, and I heard rumor that the Public Roads Administration was hiring people to go to work on the Alaska Highway. At that time, the Public Roads Administration Division office was in the old post office building at the foot of the Broadway Bridge in Portland. Division engineer was William Lynch, who later gained fame as being the man who sent Frank Andrews up to build the Alaska Highway. I went over to the Public Roads Administration office and submitted an application, and I was warned by Mr. Bill Schofield that this was going to be a rough job, that you might be living in tents, etc., but I told him that I thought I could handle it since I had worked on fire crews during the summer while living at Hydina, Oregon, and had done a lot of camping earlier. I was called and told that I would be called within a few days, and so I took all my clothes I could find down to have them washed and all ready to go. About 2 days later, while my laundry was still in the laundry, I was called and said that I should report to work on the following morning at the Portland office. Meanwhile, I had been able to buy a sleeping bag at the Oregon Outfitters for $37.50. I had a footlocker into which I stuffed all my clothes after I retrieved them from the laundry during the afternoon. We went to Seattle as a group, though I don't recall the details of the group, and stayed at the Fry Hotel in Seattle, where we were preparing to leave from the port of embarkation. We were put through quite a bit of indoctrination, including our shots so that we could go to Canada. I don't know what shots were given to us, although I do remember the biggest, strongest boy on the crew passing out cold at the time we were taking our shots. According to my record, it was on April the 22nd, as I recall, in the afternoon that we left Seattle on a boat christened the Eli D. Hoyle, which was a wooden boat constructed in Bellingham during World War I. And had been used to transport cannery workers back and forth to and from Alaska. The old boat had a few staterooms on the upper deck, a gangway or a passageway along each side below the superstructure, and all of the people that I went with from the Portland office were bedded down in the hold. And to those I came with, there were a large number of people from San Francisco with us. And in the staterooms was a group which had come from the Ogden, Utah office. We, with the exception of the crew and the armed guard crew, which manned guns at both ends of the ship, it was all Public Roads Administration personnel. I remember the old ship, and looking around inside the hold in the murky dimness, we could see the ribs and the planking and some spots could see where we could pick dry rot out of the ribs, so it didn't leave us a great sense of security. The old boat was powered by a triple expansion steam engine and made it about 7 knots.
the meal?
The ship was manned by an Army crew since it was part of the Army Transport Service, and the mess hall was presided over, I believe, by Army personnel. At any rate, the door to the mess hall through which the food was passed to the customers was on the side, and we would march by with our metal five-compartment trays and have the food put on the cold metal trays and then stand out along the rail to eat. This was not so bad the first day or two, but as we proceeded north, it got so that whatever we ate turned cold, and one day when we had turkey, it truly was cold turkey. Remember the first night out early in the morning, about 4 o'clock, we woke up and the ship was pitching up and down, and one of the San Francisco men was very, very, very seasick. And we found later that we had crossed the mouth of the Straits of Juan de Fuca and then proceeded on up behind Vancouver Island, and apparently this is a notoriously rough piece of water. In any case, I could vouch for the fact that it was that night. Well, the ship was in a blackout condition, of course, and even the hold hatch cover had to be stayed closed at night, and we had one man who had a severe case of claustrophobia and who always made his bed right at the foot of the ladder, so we had to be very careful not to step on him as we walked around. There were lights, of course, in the compartment, and the normal poker games ran almost continually. The crew consisted of quite a number of either very young men like myself or older fellows who had been on survey and construction work for many years, and so it was an interesting study and some real crusty characters who had come out of the woods during the war. Our first and only stop on the way up was at Annette Island, where we were allowed off the ship after a lecture by a young first lieutenant to all these people how to behave themselves, because there were Indians around and we needed to behave and not get ourselves in trouble. This caused some consternation and smiles on the part of some of the older men, and they wondered among themselves really what kind of a group he was talking to. It certainly was not a bunch of young Army recruits. Anyway, no fuss, but only interesting comments. We arrived at Skagway after a long and not too interesting voyage, although very scenic, and to me it was a real thrill to go up the inside passage. There was spitting snow some of the time, a lot of porpoises jumping, and the normal thing, which I guess to most was routine. But to me, the inside passage itself was an exciting thing to see, even though the weather was cold. At Skagway, we were told what different hotels we were to stay in, and five of us were sent up to the Pullen House, which was in the far northerly end of town and operated by Mrs. Harriet Pullen, who was in her own time, she having been on the gold rush and raised some boys and ran a freight wagon and had run the house for some time. Well, at the time we were there, a granddaughter was staying with her, and I remember we had been downtown, didn't find a place to eat. And Bill Gillenwater, a cook who was with us, had said, well, why don't we just buy some food in the grocery store and we'll go back up and put some sandwiches together or something like that. At any rate, when we came in the door, Mrs. Pullen and her granddaughter were in the kitchen, and she saw us and she greeted us with, hello, boys, how are you? And we went in for a moment and she said, what do you have? And we told her we had our dinner in the sack, and she said, well, why don't you lay it out here and have coffee with me this evening? So Bill laid our food out on the counter and we had dinner there with Mrs. Pullen, which is an experience I will never forget. I believe since that time the building is no longer in use, in fact burned some years ago. In the morning, all the contingent from the Eli D. Hoyle, plus quite a number of Army personnel with the 18th Engineers, went out on the White Pass Railroad, which was at that time operated by the Army using steam engines. Ours were, I think, some of the original ones. At least they had the stove in the corner and all the old wicker, which reversed back and forth depending on which way the train went. I believe they are still run to this day on the White Pass, although they may not be originals. The stop was made at Bennett, the way in, where dinner was laid out for everyone. I recall sitting down to the lunch meal there, and I don't have any idea how many people there were involved, but on the table was peach pie and cheese and pickles, which we did not know, we presumed was the dessert or something. At any rate, as we waited around, we finally realized that that was the lunch meal, so everybody had pie, cheese, and pickles for lunch. And we proceeded on our way towards Whitehorse, along Lake Bennett, to Carcross. We arrived in Whitehorse, along with, I'm not sure how many others, were billeted in the old White Pass Hotel, which, if I recall correctly, was almost just across the street from the railroad station. It was not geared for quite the pressure that was under at that time, and I recall in the dining room sitting there, and the water run down the walls because there were plugged up drains in the bathroom. I guess that is the most vivid memory I have of the place. In Whitehorse, we were advised of the limit on the amount of baggage we could take, and were told to sort our things out and store whatever we could store in an old church building in town. Don't recall the location. In any case, I sorted out to my sleeping bag and a duffel bag and left the footlocker with any books, papers, etc. there in town. The horse itself was to me a fascinating place. The river had just thawed out, the boats were still on the ways in the shipyard, and I wandered around all over among other places down to the shipyard looking around. I knew something about steam engines, and I just wanted to see what was underneath that big plume of steam that kept getting kicking up into the air. But I was in there with the camera and got some pictures, but I was advised to leave. My recorder is being kicked out, but it wasn't that severe. But I was, and I don't recall, someone was with me, I don't recall who it may have been. A few days after hauling freight from the storage depot and generally doing whatever there was to be done, we got our notice that we were being put into a crew, survey crew, to go out and work to the west from Kewaunee Lake on northerly. I distinctly recall in Whitehorse when I was told of this and I was shown on the map where it was, I called the lake Kluane and was quickly corrected by one of the locals. Plane trip to Burwash Landing was on an old Curtis Condor biplane, which I have recorded in pictures. Landed on the ice at Burwash Landing. There were approximately 4 feet of ice there, and the airport had been laid out and delineated with strips of trees out across the ice. Mine was the Yukon Southern Air Transport, which I believe later was merged with the Canadian Pacific Airways. The original crew of 13 was bunked down in two bunk cabins in the office cabin. The office cabin, I believe, containing the chief of party and the assistant, and then six of us in one cabin of the younger fellows and five of the older fellows in another cabin. Quite a motley crew with every kind of addiction, thought, and attitude of possible, of total strangers from places like from Utah, San Francisco, and Oregon, and later supplemented by our cook and some Canadians. There was initially some early tension between the San Francisco, the Portland, and the Ogden office people, which later I understood developed into a little bit of resentment on the part of the San Francisco people, since they had been left without anyone truly in charge of the operation and had to operate at lower levels than some of the other division people. It started a little bit with the fact that the Utah people, no matter what grade, age, or status, lived in the staterooms on our boat coming up, and the rest of us were down on the hold on the top of a pile of bombs as far as Hannett Island, after which we were much eased because they unloaded the bombs. The southern section, the Fort St. John section, was supervised by people from the Denver office. The Whitehorse division was supervised by the people from the Portland office, and the San Francisco division office people were scattered up and down the line, not in any position of high responsibility, at least in the early stages. I don't know what all the politics may have been later on. However, J.S. Bright, the overall district engineer in charge, was from San Francisco. Our first initial surveying involve walking south on Klamani Lake for about 5 miles and then back up on the bank a ways and arbitrarily driving a survey point in the ground and starting down the road. The Chief Fred Johnson and Bill Ash, our transitmen, later went back at night and established a bearing from off of a shot on the North Star. But at that time, we just started going and never let up. The thing that stands out and caused us to get a late start one day was bush pilot Bob Reeve, who had come to Burwash Landing and had landed on the airstrip over from the cabin, over from the trading post. And since it was so far over there, he had been talked into taking off and landing on the ice over in front of the buildings, which he did, landing the same place we had landed a couple of weeks before, except that as he taxied toward shore, one wheel started to break through the ice and then the other, and he cut the motor immediately, and he ended up nose down with the fuselage lying right on the ice. He crawled out the window and came ashore without any problem. Tonight he was prepared to instruments out of the plane and let it go. But Gene Jacko, the trader at the post, convinced him that maybe we could get it out in the morning since we had all that manpower available. The morning after the ice had solidified through the cool night and it froze up more solidly, we put some skids on the ice alongside the plane and built an A-frame and hung a chain block in it. And we would set a block across the skids, jack with a hydraulic jack under the propeller nose, jack up the propeller, take up the slacks with a very lightweight chain block, reblock it, and continue this a few inches at a time until we were able to slide some planks under the wheel of the aircraft. At that time, they took the propeller off. Jacko took it into the blacksmith shop, straightened it out as best he could, and in the next morning, Bob Reeve was able to take off south to get his airplane. He told us at that time, "Don't you forget, boys, if any of you ever see me anyplace, let me know you were here and the stakes are on me." A bill which I was never able to collect, since I understand Mr. Reeve passed away a year or so ago. All our survey crew was fed at the trading post dining room. Gene Jacko and his Indian wife, the daughter of Mr. Dixon, the two of them ran the kitchen, and we ate corn mousse, lots of potatoes, desserts, in general good food, and the sandwiches they gave us for lunch were quite adequate. It was my first experience with ham, which had a green tinge to it, but the boys all were kind of suspicious of it in the beginning, and we always started a bonfire and roasted the sandwiches before lunch, taking the ham out and sticking them on a green stick until it got well cooked. I don't know whether this kitchen was worthwhile or not. Main social event for the 3 weeks or so that we were at Burwash Landing involved an old phonograph, and the boys go down to the mess hall and dance the one step with the Indian girls. Songs which I remember hearing there, one was the Dance of the Roses and the other one recurring theme which said, "I'm sorry, that's all I can say." I don't know what the name of that record might have been. There were three girls who served the tables, Buck Dixon's sisters and sisters of Mrs. Jacko, and their names were Belle Dixon, Babe Dixon, and Ada Watt. Also, in addition to the people who were in residence at the trading post, were two Pan American Airways radio operators who were part of a chain of radio stations which Pan Am had maintained through the Yukon and Alaska. Their names were Huey Stone and Gordon. Last name I can't right now recall. A transit party consisted of the transit man, a head chainman, a rear flagman, and whatever axemen we had available at the time. The axemen were hired Canadians, beginning axeman was Louis Vukovich, who was later replaced by Tom Kirkwood, who I understand operates a big lodge down at Atlin today. Behind these transit party came two men, one running a rod and run the level to obtain the elevations on the point, and behind this most of the time was a crew of three, our party chief and myself and one other, who did all the running up and down the hill, and everyone was worried about our being able to keep up. But Billy Bassett was working with me on this crew, and we were on the run most of the time, both of us from Oregon, Billy having worked for the Weyerhaeuser Timber Company on logging railroad surveys, really knew his stuff, and started out with Everett McLean as our chief topographer, but he was later replaced by Cecil Lacey, who was a young man about my age, but who had had quite a lot of surveying experience, which is something I could never claim. Through approximately 2.5 weeks at Burwash Landing, we came to the Duke River, which was about 5 miles northwest of the landing, and by that time was running high enough so that it was very difficult to cross unless with horses. To wade was virtually impossible, so it was decided to build a footbridge. Two men waded the river hanging onto a line so that if they got swept off their feet, we could pull them into shore. And then once they got across, we threw the line over and they secured it. After that, we fabricated two piers and tried to hold them down on the water by the logs with enough weight to make them stand there until we could the operation on the next one. We ended up with two of these piers with the two-pole bridge across, and took most of the day. According to my diary, we didn't get back to the landing until about 7. Of course, that was about an hour and a half of walking time. Got the bridge built. We felt we could get to work all right for a couple more days, but we would need to move our camp pretty soon. We were getting to the point where we were doing all walking and no working. We built the bridge, but supplies started to come in from White Horse, so it began to look as if we would be moving soon. Actually, Louis Vukovich, everybody but Louis had thought that he was going to be the cook, and when he found it out, this was the reason which he went back home, and we later got a cook, which kind of took the load off my mind, as I recorded on the 20th of May. Mail came in that I'd gotten since I'd left home about a month ago on these same planes. It was a continued confusion regarding the fly planes, but really we accumulated our outfit. We finally made our move to camp on the 26th of May. After much fussing and worrying about the stove, I later found out that the big discussion between the trader, Gene Jacko, and Fred Johnson about the stove was that the cook stove, which was provided by the Public Roads Administration, was too heavy for Gene to allow one of his horses to carry it. So he and Fred made a deal where Fred left the cook stove at Burwash, and we took two small tin stoves, which I guess are classic for northern country use. They were 2 feet long with a firebox on one end and the oven on the other, small, all bent thin sheet steel. Them would go on each side of the cook of the horse very conveniently. It didn't weigh very much. First consisted of 3 10-by-12 tents and then another 10-by-12 tent for the office, all gable tents, which we slept into a tent plus two in the office tent and cook in the back of the cook tent, which was somewhat larger. It must have been probably a 14 by 16. So the tent was heated by what we call a Sibley stove, or some call a Yukon stove. At any rate, it was a cone, open bottom and the door on the sloping side, and the stove pipe out the center of the top. Setting them up, we would dig a shallow hole and set it down in, and then dig a hole in underneath the edge so that the air could come down and come into the underneath the fire. open and close the draft. It was really a matter of laying something over the hole, which was underneath the edge of the stove. So quite effective. And we used them to clear down to 30 below later on. So I had flies over the tent, which we set up as well to protect from the rain. Hearing equipment consisted of one transit, one dumpy level, and a hand crank Marchant calculator and a typewriter. Dining table was a roll of flats about a half inch by 2 inches wide, bonded together with the canvas, and it would roll up into a roll about 12 to 14 inches in diameter and as long as the width of the dining table, and it must have weighed 40 pounds when it was done, but it was possible to just build a frame with the slabbed off logs and just unroll it and you had an instant table. In the diary now that the cook tent was a 16 by 20 foot tent, 13 feet high. The survey party, which was recorded on May 30th as being at the landing and working the other way, I believe turned out to be under the supervision of Del Early, and they used the boat from Burwash Landing to go down the lake to work on, going down the lake, picking up from our line and working on southeast along the lakeshore. I do not know how far they ran their line before leapfrogging over us to the other side of the White River. At the end of the season, we had folding wooden canvas cots and mattresses, which as the season developed in August, we had to leave behind because we went on a little faster clip than that, and we slept on the ground. This was before the days of an air mattress. Times during the survey work, I was detached to help with the packers, since I had packed some on fires and knew how to unpack, and the Indian requested my help from Fred, so it gave me a little bit of variety, which I didn't find. I have hardly ridden a horse since, however. June 11th, I comment that Clyde Hill cut his foot pretty badly with the axe. Clyde Hill was the office boy in the San Francisco office, a young man of about 6'3", a real nice young man, but he had never been off the pavement before in his life, and we learned early to stand back when he was swinging the axe because we were never sure where it was going to go when he relaxed after it hit the cut. Boots had been cut with near misses a number of times, and we all knew that it would just be a matter of time until he wounded himself. After he cut his foot, he was on light duty and helped working around the camp as Flunky because he could not exercise it. It would irritate it and open the wound. I noticed that there were a lot of planes going over. This was right directly on the ferry route between the Watson Lake, Fort St. John, White Horse and Fairbanks, where the Russians were picking up the P-40s or P-39s to take them into Russia. Our white tents apparently showed up very well out in the wilderness because they were always diving over and at one time almost clipped our tent or stovepipe at Thick Anna Lake. It be on June 21st that Gordon, the radio operator's name was Warren. B. Rear was the chief locating engineer for the White Horse Division, mentioned in the June 21st entry. This man had been on the initial location for the Alaska Railroad way back in Alaska and passed away at age 95 in about 1980, I believe. Been prior to that, I'd have to check that out. Anyway, he shows up in some of the pictures. Mosquito nets continually, both on our heads during the day and over our beds at night. We were in a very swampy area much of the time, and they were a continual pest. July 1st, we note that the transit party rode to work on the horses, and this was a real breakthrough for them, since none of them had been on horseback for all summer, and taken Louis Jacko along with us to tend to the horses all day, and he got the horses to running, and needless to say, he was pretty heavily threatened by the crew later. They were pretty badly blistered and bruised over it. It didn't bother me that much because I had been riding much of the summer, but some of the older fellows were a little bit distressed with him, threatened to throw him in the lake. On July 6th, it mentions putting a toe cap on the boots. The problem we had with our boots was in walking in the moss which was underlaid by volcanic ash, our boots would slide through, fall through the moss, and the abrasive sand on the moss would wear the toes right out of the front of the boots. That's why the hobnails were needed for the front. When I refer to wearing choke boards, it's riding breeches, of which I had a pair, along with some 16-inch high boots, which I did not want to wear, but I was finally forced to do. When McGillivray referred to on the July 12th entry, was one who did the original reconnaissance through this area in company with the Army all the way through and filed a report, and there is a report on this trip, I believe, in the Department of Transportation Library. McGillivray at this writing is still living. I called him a few days ago. He is now 89 years old, but he has no material from the Alaska Highway experience. On July 12th, it mentions the boys all had to send in their guns to be registered. This, we came in to Skagway and Whitehorse. We had guns inside our sleeping bag, or inside our duffel bag, not realizing that Canada had a thing about guns. And one of the boys had a German Luger handgun, which is very much prohibited inside Canada. In any case, we were given the freedom to take them with us to Whitehorse because nobody realized what was happening. And I had even sold one to one of the radio operators in Burwash Landing, not knowing that it was illegal for me to sell it to him and illegal for him to buy it, but I believe that he got away with it without any problem. It was a little .22, which I sold him for $15. At any rate, we sent in all the guns, and the only gun we had in camp was Tom Kirkwood's 30-30 carbine until we got them back later on. One was our Canadian Maxim. July 20th, we broke our last good camp on the Donjek River and prepared to cross the river, but the river was up from all the rain, and we find ourselves on that night camped out under our tarps on the bar of the river with all of our equipment either shipped across the river or still packed up except for the sleeping bags. At the time, the cook was operating with limited resources and cooking over the campfire with limited equipment, and finally we had decided that he was going to take off home, so he packed up his dog with a little bit of stuff on, was all ready to go. He was finally talked out of it. He was a long ways away from any place, and was no outdoorsman at all. I don't know what he would have done had he been allowed to leave camp. Finally, on the 23rd, the Indians found a way to cross, and the river had gotten down. And other than a little bit of quicksand, it wasn't bad. Camp on the 23rd was on Hard Luck Creek by Salvation Lake, as I recall. Our survey crossed the Donjek River at approximately the location of the present bridge, but the Army crossed much upstream with a series of bridges and came in not too far from the trail which we took to our camp, and came into our survey line approximately where our old camp was, where we crossed the creek. Where we camped was warmed from the creek which flowed out of a lake well above camp, which is referred to later in the diary. We could swim in the lake, and it was a deep mud and organic material bottom, which when you stand up and wiggle your feet, you would go right down to the permafrost. But the insulation from the mud and organic bottom appeared to be enough to keep the water so that it was tolerable for swimming. At least it was a chance to keep clean most of the time. Lieutenant Furman, referred to in the August 7th entry of the diary, was the lieutenant in charge of the survey party for the 29th engineers who were doing the reconnaissance for the Army and following us on our survey. There was a constant bit of friction between Fred Johnson, our party chief, and John McGillivray, the supervising locating engineer. And I recall on August the 9th, the date which John came in on the plane, and Jack Edwards and I carried him in when we got back to camp, and Fred showed up and we narrated this little story to him. He told us, "Why didn't you drop the so-and-so in the lake while you had a chance?" Later was a good friend, and I found out that he had worked in Western Oregon on some of my home country. Camp that we made on the 14th of August on Lake Creek was where Graff Creek comes into Lake Creek. supplies which I received on August 27th, I believe, were mailed from my father in Oregon. I remember the shoes were a pair of cork boots I used to wear for logging, and they stirred up an awful lot of dust when I worked and moved into cookhouse. Sam Johnson, our packer, who was drafted to cook on the 29th of August, had cooked for some years off and on for Jacko in his hunting parties, and was acquainted with quite a number of influential people. He and Jimmy Joe each had a Model 70 Winchester rifle, which had been given to them by departing hunters. I believe they were, I know they were caliber 30-06, but they were the latest thing and the fine guns. Incident about the raft on August the 30th is documented in one of the rolls of 35 millimeter pictures. On September 4th, the record is of a trip when I went back to Pickhandle Lake with Private Lambert of the 29th Engineers to bring some food. The Army 29th Engineers ran completely out of food, and we had to go to our base camp to get some for them. A picture of the Army soldier beside Pickhandle Lake with two or three horses is of this trip. And referred to on September 8th, I believe, was Lieutenant Colonel Hodge of the 18th Engineers. And Major Weber, the dentist, had been up the White River looking at the native copper deposits, etc., and the Major had a piece of copper which he showed us later. I recall when Fred told me that I was going to have to be the cook, I told him I would do all the cooking except he had to bake the bread because my bread leaked. It seemed that when we rolled it up in the pack boxes at night. This was with the old magic dry yeast, and we had to keep it warm overnight in our fly tent. It was freezing cold every night. So we would roll it up in the blankets, and in the morning when we unrolled the blankets, of course the dough had spread out all over everything, and we scraped it off as best we could off the horse blankets and put it back in the pot, keeping most of the dirt out. But it seemed like that I had always had such big holes that the jam leaked through. So Fred, I talked him into doing the baking if I'd do the rest. Collison was the bush pilot who made the trips, flew us out on the 13th of September back to Burghorst Landing. Comments about the dance that something is rotten in Denmark, I think, were the fact that the Army had infiltrated Burghorst Landing and the treatment that they gave to the natives there was not quite the same as what we as our survey crew had given, and I don't think that some of the people there were quite prepared to accept the difference in attitude between the Army and our own people. Camp we moved to on September 16th was the camp about 5 miles west of the Duke River on the Dry Meadow, and the road had already been built to that point, so it was just like being downtown. Who stopped in on the 17th of September was the Chief of Construction for the White Horse Division and the Assistant Division Engineer under Mr. F.E. Andrews. We got to our camp at Dry Meadow. We had a significantly better setup as far as food is concerned than we had when we were with the pack string, and this included dried eggs, dried milk, and many things which were just beginning to come into use and which were not available when we had gone out in the spring. Sam and I were cooking one time during mid-September or late September. We got wondering about all the grease we had and the big cooking pans we had and the dried eggs, and we found on the side of a dried egg package and had a recipe for donuts, so we thought maybe the boys would like to have some donuts. Then it ended up in the traditional situation where you keep adding more flour and more whatever the liquid is until you get the right kind of a mix, and since we had lots of grease, we ended up with a great dish pan full of donut dough, and as I recall, somewhere between 40 and 50 dozen donuts, as a result of which we put a bucket full of donuts in every tent, and we eased up on the amount of meat used for several days. The boys were eating donuts as they take charge at night, and we finally got rid of them, but it was kind of a classic experience. On October 11th, we started days of digging holes for the soil surveyor, which consisted of every 1,000 feet along the survey line, starting at the Donjek River. We stopped and dug a hole down to where we could find the permafrost, and also waited for the materials engineer, Mr. Simpson, to decide if he wanted more holes to be dug.
Jack and I had been working all summer long and were in pretty good shape, significantly better than the soil surveyors. October 12th, we finished our soil survey and walked straight out to the road. And then the next morning when we started back, Mr. Simpson thought that he had a shortcut and decided not to follow our tracks back to the line. The clouds and fog settled down around us so that it was difficult to keep our orientation, even though I had a pretty good general idea which way we were going. But we kept working toward the south and crossed the survey line in the middle of an open meadow, and since we didn't kick a stake, we never saw it, and kept working toward the base of the hills until we cut the pack trail, at which time I knew then where I was because I had packed the horses, even though Jack didn't know where he was. So we then went back down to our camp at Murray Creek and followed that trail on back down till we picked up the line, and then soil surveyed the rest of the day by walking back down Quill Creek to the road. I estimated that we had walked around 21 miles that day, along with the digging holes. I never saw Mr. Simpson again after that time until about 1968, when he came to the Salem, Oregon division office where I was working, and as division engineer. Came in earlier before being assigned to the area, and he was being introduced to the staff. He remembered and turned and said to the people there, the last time he'd seen me, we would walk through that we got lost up in the brush in the burwash, implying that I was the one that got him lost. He was a good friend, though, and I have no complaints.
Bud Munson referred to in the October 16th comment was a superintendent for Elliott Construction Company. Later was a high-ranking engineer with the Washington State Highway Department. I'd spent in the USO house at Lewanee refers to an old building which was there at one time a store or had some kind of a countertop there. I think it is now what was either a Martin or a Mink farmhouse or something. It's now called Old Silver City. It was at that time belonged to Jack Hayden, I believe. The Earhart referred to in the October 21st entry is Eric Earhart, who was the chief locating engineer for at least a portion of the Fort St. John division. He later worked in the Washington office, and I saw him when I worked in Washington during 1969-1976. He had already retired at that time. That I came to on October 22nd was at Contact Creek, south of Watson Lake, where two of the engineering regiments had joined up on the southern section of the road. Farland referred to on the October 31st forward was a man who had it within his authority to decide what to do on these surveys and may well have been a supervisor for Earhart. I may be mixed up on this. It was from the Denver division. Farland referred to in the November 12th entry was one of those who's referred to in the bibliography of my manuscript who made the initial dog team reconnaissance in the Fort Nelson area, and it is an interesting narrative which is in the DOT library in Washington. November 16th, I see a comment, lots of trouble with watery gas. The truck we were riding on, or that I was riding on, which was a big Ford dump truck full of assembled stovepipe, had the bulb alongside the cab, and the army dumps had their barrels on end, and so water had run down inside the barrels and then got into the gas, and it would come through and freeze up in the sediment bulb out exposed to the air, and my truck driver would just take the sediment bulb off, throw it out in the road and touch a match to it and burn the gas out, which would melt the water out, put the bulb back on, the way we go again. It had a metal bulb, not a glass one. I believe my comments on November 19th talking about the Prime Minister, the Mayor of LaGuardia, Secretary Stimson, etc. may have been a little optimistic, but it's a classic case of a rumor ran wild. I do believe that Grover Whalen was there. I remember him being pointed out to me. He was the official greeter for New York City during Mayor LaGuardia's time. But I don't know that any of these other folks outside of maybe some generals were there, and they wouldn't have been staying in our camp anyway. McCarthy's mentioned in the November 23rd letter entry ran the lodge at Teslin, and as I recall, a couple of our survey crews lived nearby there from time to time and were well acquainted with the family and had very fine words. They apparently were. He was a retired mounted policeman, and I think they had two daughters who had gone south to school. But they maintained a very high standards, always dressed for dinner, and were very fine folks. Send us a 1942 adventure on the Alaska Highway. I went to Haines for the winter, then back in the summer, spring of 1943, working out of the camp 152 miles west from Whitehorse.
This is the end of the Yukon discussion on this tape. There's nothing on the other side except whatever wasn't erased off, which I don't know what that is. At any rate, if you folks can make a transcription of this for me, I would really appreciate it, and any other help I can be to you, please let me know.